We're going to hear now about the recession in Mexico. Even as the U.S. economy is looking up, Mexico's is shrinking fast. NPR's Jason Beaubien begins his report at a market in Mexico City that's billed as the largest market in Latin America.
The Central de Abasto is a huge, sprawling market near the Mexico City airport. It covers more than 750 acres, making it about 8 times bigger than the Mall of America outside Minneapolis. Everything from plastic plates to rope to dish soap is for sale in different stalls around the Central. The complex, however, is primarily a wholesale food and flower market, where housewives and street vendors are also more than welcome to shop. There are walls of orange marigolds, pyramids of squash, bales of cilantro. Fat, shiny peppers are piled next to immaculately clean white onions. There's one section devoted entirely to carrots. Petra Flores de la Cruz sells celery, broccoli, and lettuce from a long wooden table. She says the situation with the economic crisis right now is really bad. Before, I used to sell 300 boxes of celery a day, she says. Now I move about 50 or 40 boxes. There's been a lot of change, a lot. An herb vendor nearby says he started breaking up the thick bunches of parsley and cilantro into halves and quarters to make them more affordable. He says he never used to have to do that. And shoppers also say they're buying only the basics.
Me estoy olvidando. Me estoy olvidando de la carne, del pescado, el filete cuesta ciento y tantos.
I'm no longer buying fish or steak, says 67-year-old Candelaria Gonzalez. She's lugging a canvas bag stuffed with vegetables. The price of beef has gone up to 80 pesos a kilo, and the minimum wage is only 50 pesos a day. Imagine, she says, all you can get for the minimum wage is beans and tortillas. The Mexican minimum wage is actually 55 pesos, or just over $4 a day. In a country where nearly half the population already lived below the poverty line, the global economic downturn has slashed all of Mexico's largest sources of revenue. Oil profits are in a free fall. Automotive exports dropped 40% this year. Tourism got battered by swine flu and the vicious drug war. And cash sent home from Mexicans working in the States is going down at an unprecedented pace. Alejandra Villagomez is a professor of macroeconomics at the Tecnológico de Monterrey, one of the country's top private universities. He predicts Mexico's economy will contract 7 to 8% in 2009.
Basically, we have one of the worst recessions in the last 40 years.
Villagomez says Mexico has suffered in this global crisis because of its heavy dependence on exports to the United States. He says the slowdown has been felt nationwide and the fallout will be too.
One of the main problems will be the increase in poverty. That is a very important problem for the government.
Back at the Central de Abasto, porters push huge piles of goods through the narrow alleyways on hand trucks that they call diablos, or devils. Musicians wander amidst the produce, trying to raise a few pesos. In the seafood section, fish, shrimp, and squid from both of Mexico's coasts are laid out on beds of ice. Men wielding cleavers chop up octopuses on large wooden blocks. Noel Vasquez Lozano is surrounded by huge stainless steel trays filled with fish. He says sales have been going down for roughly 2 years now. Vasquez says they keep waiting for the next week, the next month, for things to get better, but it's always just the same. Sales are really weak. Vasquez says the worst part is there's no end in sight, and many economists agree with him, saying it will take Mexico several years to recover from this downturn. Jason Beaubien, NPR News, Mexico City.
With the housing market in turmoil for the past year, the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, has come to the rescue of many. It's now responsible for about a third of new mortgages, 10 times more than just a few years ago. And as the federally insured loan program has grown, so has its rate of defaults. The FHA is expected to acknowledge soon that its insurance reserves have slipped below a critical threshold. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
Not everyone can get a mortgage anymore. The days of if you can breathe, you can get a loan are over. But it might be hard to tell from watching the ads that are out there.
We're authorized by the federal government to offer FHA loans to homeowners with less than perfect credit.
This ad comes from a company called Premium Capital Funding LLC. It goes by the name Top Dot Mortgage.
And your credit score may not even be a factor. Applying is easy. Call the number on your screen.
According to FHA data, over the last 2 years, Top Dot's loans defaulted at nearly 2.5 times the national average. In some cases, the borrowers never made a single payment. FHA Commissioner David Stevens says any FHA lender whose default rate is more than 150% of the norm has a problem.
An institution that has that high a compare ratio is something that would be very concerning to me and will be one that we're looking at more closely going forward. And if they don't perform at the levels that we would expect and that the taxpayers would expect, we need to make sure that they either improve or they get out of the program.
Top Dot officials declined to be interviewed for this story. But in an email, a company lawyer said Top Dot is working to improve its loan performance by, among other things, adopting more stringent credit requirements. But Top Dot isn't alone. There are more than 900 small FHA-approved lenders that experts say have unacceptable default rates. Guy Sakala is the publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance.
The FHA business has been like a magnet for smaller lenders looking to carve out niches in loans that have lower down payments and slightly lower underwriting requirements.
FHA requires only 3.5% down, and credit score requirements are flexible. Some lenders are taking full advantage of that flexibility, and some are probably breaking the law. It reminds Sakala of the subprime mortgage market of the past.
You know, in the current mortgage market environment where we kind of have plain vanilla mortgages, there's not a lot of opportunity for the small entrepreneurial, is the best way we could describe it, company who wants to make a niche for themselves in the mortgage market. FHA is one of the only avenues still left.
A mortgage company can follow all of FHA's guidelines to the letter and still issue some really bad loans, loans that are destined to fail. But now FHA officials are making it clear they aren't okay with that, says Brian Chappelle with Potomac Partners, a mortgage industry consulting firm.
The message that's being sent is that there is a new sheriff in town at FHA and that they are going to pursue investigations to see just what the causes are for these high default rates, where in the past, I don't think a lot of people felt that they really had anything to worry about if they had a high default rate.
FHA recently helped shut down one major lender, and now it's going after another, Ideal Mortgage Bankers, also known as Lend America. The company is fighting the government's efforts to kick it out of the FHA program and said in a statement it plans to continue to provide affordable financing for those borrowers in need. And the reality is, these companies with unacceptably high default rates are on the margins. Guy Sakala says most of FHA's defaults are being driven by the recession.
They've made loans during a period when housing prices have been declining, so a lot of the loans are underwater. It's not like anybody's really immune from this, so it would be expected that FHA would take some serious losses in this kind of economy and environment.
FHA officials say they're open to tightening the loan program's rules, but they say there's a careful balance to strike. If the rules are too tough, some buyers would be pushed out of the market, buyers that are needed to help the housing market recover. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The economy may be starting to grow, but people are still losing jobs. A few firms, as a matter of policy, refused to lay off even a single employee. New Hampshire Public Radio's John Greenberg looks at a couple of them.
The Hypertherm factory sits hidden in the woods, not far from Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. Inside, in a testing room, a jet of superheated ionized gas slices smoothly through an inch of plate steel. Hypertherm is one of the world's top manufacturers of plasma cutting tools. Director of Operations Jim Miller says when the world is making big, heavy things, Hypertherm does quite well.
Maybe a shipbuilder, automotive manufacturing. Anywhere where you see flat steel, you would see an application for our products.
Unfortunately, late last year, the making of ships and cars pretty much ground to a halt. Sales of cutting systems at Hypertherm dropped 50%. How many workers did the company lay off? None. It put them to work doing other things. Normally, Lindsay Grace works on the production floor. Now she rakes leaves and maintains the grounds.
In the beginning, I was really scared to lose my job, and now I've had the opportunity to just come and do something different to help the company out.
Hypertherm saves money by doing everything in-house that it possibly can. Plus, it puts workers into training or assigns them to teams to rejigger the production line. The goal is to emerge from recession in a better position to compete. Company founder and CEO Dick Couch sees no tension between doing well by the employees and doing well by the company.
Once you have a highly trained technical workforce, the last thing you want to do is lay them off. And this isn't altruism. It's good business.
Couch says if he were making T-shirts, this strategy would fail. High-end products, experienced workers, and guaranteed jobs are a winning combination. Very few firms fit this mold, but Hypertherm is not alone. The granddaddy of the no-layoff companies is Lincoln Electric in Cleveland, Ohio. The maker of welding systems has been around for well over 100 years. It's a global company with over $1 billion in sales. Lincoln Electric CEO John Stropke says people considering this model need to go into it with their eyes wide open.
This doesn't come without additional pressure and challenges for management. And I would say equally, it doesn't come without additional pressures and challenges for the workforce.
Managers give up the flexibility to hire and fire as they please. Workers give up a guaranteed paycheck. Profit sharing is a big part of the model. When business is good, pay goes up. When it goes down, so does your pay. At Lincoln Electric, the work week shrank to 32 hours. Labor journalist Frank Collar just finished a book about no-layoff companies. Collar says this model rubs organized labor the wrong way. They prefer a guaranteed income to a guaranteed job.
Union leaders were very, very suspicious of this. They saw this as a tool for exploitation. And there's no question that in some work environments it probably was.
But Collar says today workers at these companies do very well. The typical Lincoln Electric assembler can make over $70,000. Jordan Siegel at the Harvard Business School says the American economy would benefit if more firms adopted this model of shared gain and shared sacrifice. He's been doing work in South Korea, where the recession had relatively little impact on unemployment.
There's been just a lot of this kind of shared sacrifice, people sharing some reductions in compensation in order to avoid layoffs.
If these firms, both overseas and at home, are so successful, why don't more companies jump on board? Siegel says mainly because this idea is too different. He hopes the recession prompts more executives to take off the blinders when it comes to the no-layoff option. For NPR News, I'm John Greenberg in Concord, New Hampshire.
Tomorrow, the government comes out with its monthly unemployment numbers, and there are fears that the jobless rate could reach 10%. Of course, that number is only part of the picture of unemployment in this country. So for more perspective, we've brought in David Leonhardt of The New York Times. David, welcome back to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
We're around 10% now, but that's not the only number, the only measure of unemployment, underemployment, or just plain struggle, is it?
That's right. That includes only people who are actively looking for work, so that they've looked in the last few weeks. There are obviously a lot of people out there who are unemployed and would like to work, but have not actively looked in the last few weeks. Maybe they've gotten discouraged. And this number doesn't include them. It also doesn't include people who would like to be working full-time but can find only part-time work. And so when you wrap in that second group, the people who would like to be working full-time but are working part-time, you get a rate of underemployment of about 16%. So really that means one out of every six people who would like to be working full-time right now and has been actively looking for full-time work isn't able to find it.
No matter how many times I hear that calculation, it makes your jaw drop a little bit. I mean, 10% is still, you can wish it off and say it's only 10%. 16 starts to sound really, really, really serious.
It does. And in some states, including California, it's up around 20%. This rate of underemployment is still not quite as high as it was in the early 80s, but it's getting there very quickly, and it's getting very close.
You write in the New York Times that the monthly jobs report that's coming out on Friday is a more important one than usual. Why would that be?
Because for a number of months over the summer, things were getting better. The number of job losses each month was shrinking. Wage growth was picking up a little bit. And then things slid backward in September. Job losses grew. Wage growth slipped a little bit. And so the question is, was that some change or was September just a blip? And we're going to get a really good sense of that tomorrow.
Now, we did just have official economic growth come out the other day for the third quarter. How does that fit in here?
Just think about a business. If you were running a business and you saw your sales picking up, you wouldn't immediately go out and hire new workers. You would try to get your existing workforce to meet that new demand. And so we should see growth before we see growth in employment.
Where's the recovery going to come from?
The first answer to that is we can't be exactly sure. People don't often know where economic growth is going to come from. That being said, I'll mention a couple of possibilities. One, exports are possible, and we have seen some real improvement in the economic relationship between China and the United States in the last few months, and we can hope that will continue.
Meaning that the American companies might actually be able to sell more stuff to China.
Yeah, meaning that the balance between how much they are selling to us and how much we're selling to them is less bad than it used to be. We could also hope that there are a number of ways in which we could have a more investment-based economy rather than a consumption-based economy. So whether that is alternative energy, whether it is scientific research and medical research and healthcare, we could hope that we would move away from this economy that is based so much on consumer spending and move more toward one that is based on investment.
Is that realistic?
I think it is realistic. I'm not sure it's going to happen. But what's unusual is what a large portion of our economy has come to be based on consumer spending. It's bigger than it has been in recorded history in this country. It's bigger than it is in other countries. So that's really what's atypical.
There was a time, as you know well, up until about the 1970s when the U.S. economy was driven by exports. We had a trade surplus with the rest of the world. We were the workshop to the world. Is there any possibility of anything remotely like that economy coming back?
I don't think like that economy, and I don't think we should be too nostalgic for that economy. I think it's important to remember that countries that have a much greater share of their economy based on exports than we do are poorer than we are. Our income is 30% higher than Germany's. They have a lot more exports than we do, but we don't want the German economy. And so a lot of that kind of industry that we had in this country pays less than the kinds of jobs we have right now. Now, we still want to be doing more exporting than we're doing. We want to be exporting both goods and services. That's part of the reason that the Chinese currency policy is so important. We also want to make sure that we're educating our workforce so they can be making the kind of goods that other countries want. But I don't think we should want to go back to the 70s. I think we should want an economy where we're exporting higher value goods than Germany is today or that we were in the 1970s.
David Leonhardt of the New York Times, thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.